Hello and welcome to the Spartan Spirit podcast, where we analyze what's best for the West by discussing the impact of government policies, business practices, and misinformation on the modern Western world. We'll look at relevant research and take a tough-minded approach drawn from the roots of the Western world, ancient Sparta. In other words, a stoic and pragmatic society-first mindset. Hence the notion of the Spartan spirit. My aim is to awaken the Spartan spirit in you, so that you can play your part in challenging and correcting misguided policies and practices that weaken the West, even if all that means is that you talk to your friends about what you've heard here today. I'm your host, Bill Kourouliakos. I'm a retired senior Royal Australian Air Force officer. Welcome, and I hope you enjoy the show. This happens to be the very first Spartan Spirit podcast, and as such, I'm going to set the scene for the podcast series. Firstly, we'll discuss what I mean when I use the terms Western world and Spartan spirit. And as an example, we'll finish today's session with a pointed look at how cultural reform is affecting Western militaries. Let's start off with trying to define what I mean when I say Western world. Firstly, there are a few terms that are bandied about, such as Western society, or Western civilization, or Western culture. Although there are differences in these terms, we'll use them interchangeably to describe the Western world. And there are many definitions for these terms. Let's start with a Google search, which delivers up these tenets of Western culture: individualism, consumerism, democracy, personal responsibility, and free enterprise. Some others add in the notion of nationalism. You can also find the following definitions of the West, many of which are not really appropriate. Firstly, anti-Islam. This was true for many centuries after the rise of Islam. White versus black. One only needs to look at the USA in the post-World War II era to see that the West was a white America where Anglo-Saxons ruled, and supposedly lesser people like Italians and Greeks were tolerated as strange quasi-whites. Another view of the West is that it's reflective of British descendants. How about anti-communist nations, particularly after World War II? Also, democratic nations versus non-democratic nations, particularly those that use derivatives of the Westminster parliamentary system, such as Canada, Australia, USA, and India. But these are clearly subjective and narrow views. Instead, let's look at what some scholars have to say about the West. Sophia Lyon of the University of California said that Western culture stems from ancient Greece and does not describe any specific group or belief, but instead it describes tendencies within cultural thought and practices, tendencies which favor the plight of the individual rather than the collective. In other words, she's saying the West is about individualism or individual rights. Kwam Appiah, and I apologize for the pronunciation, of New York University said, and I'm going to quote here, "We think of Western culture and values as being characterized by democracy, liberalism, enlightenment, scientific progress, and individualism." I'll add a little note here. Again, we see the term individualism. He went on to say, "The West sees its culture as a birthright to be passed on from generation to generation through the ages, beginning as far back as Athenian democracy and traced through our modern world." Appiah used the phrase "from Plato to NATO" to describe the journey that Western culture has taken in pushing its view about democracy and individualism onto other nations. But, he concluded, that there isn't anything of substance that truly defines what the West is. Rather, he says, the West is a mix of other cultures. There are others who made notable forays into defining the West, such as Harvard professor Sam Huntington, who wrote the much maligned, but still relevant, Clash of Civilizations, and I recommend you read that book. It's a hallmark in the discussion of Western society or societies in general across the globe. And he argued that the West is formed from those nations that seek to push democracy and individualism onto other cultures. We could also look at British philosopher A.C. Grayling, who noted that the West is generally comprised of those nations that use derivatives of the Westminster parliamentary system, as we mentioned earlier. If you're interested in understanding more about cultural definitions, I highly recommend reading both of these authors. In summarizing this section, I'll note that there isn't any consensus on what the West is, other than to say that democracy and individualism tend to be the central tenets of Western culture, And if we want to narrow the definition, we could add in that the Western world is the world that acts to expand and protect democracy and individualism across the rest of the world. Taking this view of what the West is, you could loosely say that the West stemmed from Sparta and Athens in the 500 to 300 BC era, although their democracies were limited and people like Plato would have been appalled that every citizen is allowed to vote, because Plato felt that the average person would only vote based on his or her personal interests rather than the good of the nation. The West's tenets then migrated to Rome, largely through the form of Stoicism, and then became entwined with the rise of Christianity, which found itself defending against Islam, hence that earlier notion of the West meaning anti-Islam. Drawing a long bow, the West's culture had a resurgence in the 1200s, after which it led to European liberal democracies, mostly thanks to societal developments in England, where individualism, free enterprise, and democracy began to make their marks. From there, the West's principles made their way to the U.S., and it was in the U.S. that democracy and individual rights truly gained hold. Of course, this narrative is a little bit flawed, because much of the West's history is the story of monarchs and slavery. Suffice to say that using my narrow definition, the West is epitomized by the USA, because since World War II, the U.S. and its closest allies have actively advocated for democracy and individualism to the rest of the world. Thus, the West includes countries such as the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, much of Western Europe, and a few others such as Japan. And it is those countries that we will examine on the Spartan Spirit when we consider how government policies, business practices, and misinformation affect the modern Western world. If the West is to hold on to its culture of democracy and individual rights, it must promote and defend that democracy and those individual rights. To do so, the West must maintain a sufficiently robust national power. I'll describe that in greater detail later on. In particular, the West must remain able to influence regionally and globally through its constituent nations' inherent attributes, economics, and their militaries. Some might view this as nationalism, but for those that do, I would say to you, what is the alternative when facing threats? Should we do as A.C. Grayling, the philosopher, says, and divest ourselves of nation-states? He sees nations as the cause of wars. And if you're interested in his point of view, read his book titled War. It's very thought-provoking, and I highly recommend it. He also admitted that eventually one must weigh up the notion of how to defend one's values, and that the only way to defend a culture is to have a nation-state that is able to defend itself, whether that is economically or militarily, or through negotiation and policy. This is where I draw on the Spartan spirit. It's my belief that to maintain the West's ability to defend democracy and individualism, we need to draw upon the tough-minded, community-first mindset the Spartans had. In particular, the notion of Stoicism that can be derived from Sparta's legacy. Stoicism was founded as a philosophy by Zenos in Athens around 300 BC, but many scholars believe that Zenos had some admiration for Spartan culture and that Stoicism thus partly stemmed from a view of the Spartan way of life. To understand a bit more deeply what I mean by the Spartan spirit and how this Spartan legacy came to be, I'll now take you on a historical journey. The Spartans came from a group of small villages in central Peloponnesus, which is a large isthmus in southwestern Greece. That isthmus has two mountain ranges. They run north-south and have a plain on the east coast, and there's a plain on the west coast, and in the middle is a plain, and there's a river that runs through the middle called the Evrotas River, and it was on that river that these small villages were founded. Now, that area between the two mountain ranges was called Laconia, and the people that lived in there were Lacedaemonians. So the Spartans actually referred to themselves as Lacedaemonians, but we're going to call them Spartans. Now, surrounded by mountains, they were isolated. And around 900 BC, and the date is variable, depends on what source you go and look at, but let's just call it 900 BC, so 3,000 years ago, this guy by the name of Lycurgo convinced his fellow Spartans that they needed to do something different to be competitive in what was probably a very tough world. They implemented a voting system of governance. They established two kings, not one king. They had a council of elders, and all Spartan men could vote. that system was one in which the council and the kings didn't actually decide anything other than determining what was going to be voted upon. They also implemented a system by which they apportioned land equally amongst the Spartan men so that you didn't have haves and have-nots. They enforced a communal lifestyle so they all ate from the same food sources, which again was part of a good communal lifestyle, and it avoided internal conflict. You didn't have haves and have-nots. And this allowed them to implement the last element of what Licurgo wanted, which was an elite land army. Now they started building their strength, and their influence grew, and they conquered the Taygetos mountain range, which was the mountain range to the west of Sparta. On the other side of the Taygetos mountain range was this area called Messenia, and the Helots lived there. Now the Spartans conquered that population, and they absorbed the Helots as slaves. That labor facilitated the growth of the Spartan army, because Sparta then had time to train its young boys and its men in the arts of war. And they had a very strict and tough minimalist training regime, which went through their entire childhood. And it taught them a few things. They became athletes. They became super athletes. They learned how to work together. They developed tactics. The phalanx was developed by the Spartans, and it worked really well, because in battle, they trusted each other and they worked together as a team. They had strict adherence to laws, no mercy for the weak, and through that sense of community that they had by having gone through this similar, really tough experience, they developed loyalty to each other, and they developed loyalty to their nation, patriotism. Now, let's not confuse that term with the modern penchant for using patriotism to describe right-wing fanaticism. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about love of country. And there's a statue in modern-day Sparta. So if you go to the center of Sparta and you walk down the main boulevard towards the soccer stadium, you get to the end of the road, and there on a pedestal is Leonidas. That was the king that took 300 Spartans to Thermopylae, and I'll talk a bit about that in a second. And on his statue, him standing there with his shield and his spear and his Spartan helmet looking very proud, is this inscription, and it says, "Go tell the Spartans, you stranger passing by, that here, obedient to their laws, we lie." And what they're saying by that inscription is that to be Lacedaemonian came to be known or synonymous with good order and lawfulness. And that society left us with a modern legacy, a way of life called Spartanism, which we all know and understand. It's a minimalist way of life. It's about stoicism in your mindset, putting up with whatever life throws at you and getting on with it and getting the job done. In fact, if you look at where stoicism, the term, came from, it's a philosophy that evolved in Athens, but the Athenian philosophers were looking at Sparta when they thought of stoicism and they created the concept of stoicism. And so that's where it came from. Of course, they also developed an elite military, and that's the legacy that we think about when we think of the Spartans. They had a couple of sayings which capture the sense of that elitism. The first one being, "Itan e epitas." That's translated to, "with your shield or on your shield." And what it really means is, win the battle or die trying. So they had that mindset. You know, we don't go into a fight unless we're going to win. And their most famous battle, Thermopylae, happened around 480 BC. Leonidas, that's the statue that I talked to you about just a second ago, Leonidas took 300 Spartans, and they were helping the rest of the Greeks to fend off a Persian invasion. Now, they only sent 300 because they had some cultural thing happening back in Sparta, and they didn't want to send most of their army. So only 300 went. Now, these, of course, were Spartan warriors. All Spartan warriors were elite. These 300 guys went to the pass at Thermopylae. Along came the Persian army. It was a narrow pass, so they couldn't be surrounded, and they met head-to-head. The Persian king said, "Hey, you Greeks, you know what? I've got thousands of soldiers here. How about you lay down your arms and just give up?" Well, Leonidas said, "Molon lave," which translates to, "If you want it, come and get it." Well, the Persians tried, and several thousand of them died trying. Now, those Greeks didn't live either, but they set themselves in history as being the elite of the elite. To be a Spartan warrior is to be an elite warrior. To be part of a Spartan community is to be part of an elite, tough community. And that's the image that we have of the Spartans in modern times. Now, that's epitomized by the image of their helmet. And it's the logo I use for the Spartan Spirit podcast. Nothing lasts forever, though. Sparta's demise began with probably its greatest glory. They had to face the outside world, and in time they decided, well, you know what, we need to take over Greece. And it was because of whatever Athens was doing at the time. So in 432 BC, they attacked and they conquered Athens. They took control of Greece, but Greece was too big for them. Sparta was a small area. They were a small community, and it was too big for them. They lost their sense of isolationism. They lost their way of life. And only 50 years later, they started to taste defeat. By 200 BC, their time was past. They were no longer an elite and powerful society. And today, if you go to Sparta, it's a small city, maybe 50,000 people, and they produce olives and oranges. You can learn a bit more about Sparta and what I mean by the Spartan spirit if you go and look at spartanspirit.au. That's one word, Spartan spirit. It's my homepage, and you can read up on minimalism, stoicism, patriotism, and military excellence. And it's those components that we find throughout history. That legacy was in the Japanese samurai, in the British Navy of the 1800s, in the German Army of the 1930s, in U.S. Special Forces in the latter half of the 1900s. The hallmarks were morale and esprit de corps. And that's the legacy that the Spartans left us, and we still live and breathe it today. But in our modern world, there are some cultural reforms happening that are not supportive of that mindset. And that's what I want to talk to you about here for the second half of the podcast. In our modern world, we've got increased individuality, adjustments for gender, woke politics, meaning from a broad view, increasing opportunities for marginalized groups, a greater acceptance of minority groups. Now, most of this stuff is, of course, very good. And, you know, we want people to feel good about themselves and we want people to have rights. But I'll tell you what, some of these things are not conducive to military esprit de corps, especially individuality, and they threaten the combat effectiveness of Western militaries. And it's my assertion that militaries are not necessarily a reflection of modern society because military tasks are unique. Some modern cultural reform is just not applicable to the military, and it's what I want to talk about here. I'm going to give you an example now. I think we need to be asking ourselves, what is it that we want our military to be capable of doing, and do these cultural reform programs enhance or detract from those capabilities? Or put another way, are societal norms conducive to the effective development of the military capabilities that we require? And I'm going to give you an example. I'm going to use the Australian Defence Force's journey of cultural reform and how it impacts morale and esprit de corps. Now, the Australian Defence Force embarked on this cultural reform journey stemming from incidents and reviews that came in the early 2010s. So there was a 2011 sex scandal at the Australian Defence Force Academy. There was a review of the treatment of women in the ADF called the Broderick Review. In 2012, there was a review of abuse in the ADF called the Piper Report. You can Google all of these things. They're easily found. They all together resulted in a wide-ranging cultural reform, which culminated in something called Pathway to Change, and it was implemented in 2015. It was really a steamroller of cultural reform. Now, one of the key proponents of this was Dave Morrison. He was the Chief of Army, Lieutenant General Dave Morrison, and he fought hard for equity. And he very famously said, and there's a video clip of this on the internet, quote, "Those who think it is okay to behave in a way that demeans or exploits their colleagues have no place in this army. If that does not suit you, then get out." Now, he said it way better than I did. Go and Google it. It's a cracker of a video. Now, he weeded out people that were not demonstrating inclusive behaviors. He weeded out people who were doing unacceptable things like trading photos of girls on the internet, workers in the office. These are military people, or military officers and non-commissioned sergeants and warrant officers. And he fired about 200 of them. You know, and I'd say, based on the things I've read, yep, those are probably well-deserved. But he set a trend in motion. He made it difficult to challenge cultural reform. He didn't ask, what's the impact of what I'm doing? Now, clearly getting rid of unacceptable behavior is a good thing, but the question is, what is unacceptable? And we forgot to be outcomes focused in this. When you make a change, is it good for military combat effectiveness? Now, it's good to get rid of these bad apples in a group. Of course it is, because they disrupt morale and esprit de corps. But Morrison had a tough challenge on his hands. He had a bunch of young men in his military units which were not reflective of normal society, because military units don't do normal things, and in his words, he had to generate a military better connected to the values of the society from which it gained its moral legitimacy. Tough challenge. He easily found the bad apples. But what next? And I'll tell you what he did next. He started to look at gender-specific language. And one example was, he said, you can't use the word guys. Well, if you go and Google this and look at the varying views on this, it's a contentious point. A lot of people, including very senior, powerful women, would say guys is acceptable because it's generic. And my point here is, how far do you go with this cultural reform? Once it starts impacting your combat capability, well, maybe it's going too far. Well, as Morrison said when he became Australian of the Year, the reform program was unstoppable, and it had a life of its own. And then in came Angus Campbell as the Chief of Army, and he took it to a whole new level. So let's talk specifically about one of the directives that he issued. On the 17th of April, 2018, he issued a ban on the use of death symbology. He later became the Chief of Defense Force, and made it across the entire Defense Force. So what did he mean by death symbology? Well, he said that this means stuff like skull and crossbones, the Grim Reaper, and the Spartan helmet. And he said such emblems, and this is a quote here, are at odds with Army's values and the ethical force we seek to build and sustain. He didn't define what an ethical force is, by the way, in that directive. He went on to say, quote, such symbology is always ill-considered and implicitly encourages the inculcation of an arrogant hubris and general disregard for the most serious responsibility of our profession, the legitimate and discriminate taking of life. He went on to say, as soldiers, our purpose is to serve the state, applying violence with humility always and compassion wherever possible. The symbol to which I refer erodes this ethos of the symbology. To which I refer erodes this ethos of service. Wow, there are some cracker statements in there. It's unbelievable that he would say that he would use the word humility or arrogant hubris. And I'm going to give you some concrete examples about why I think he just went way off the planet with this. So it was a storm of debate that came out of that. And I'm going to take you through the research that underpins both sides. So let's look at the pro side. The Swedish Defense University published a paper. You can Google this. And they argued that if militaries don't reflect societal norms, then they will fail to attract young recruits. That Swedish paper, by the way, did not address whether the modern penchant for individuality and free will are actually suitable characteristics for a military organization. That's a whole other question. And I would argue that actually, you know what, there's still plenty of people lining up the front door of the military, whether they have patches or not. But let's just set that aside for the moment and accept that they're saying, hey, you know, we should be looking at our societal norms and whether the military, in fact, does reflect them. The Conversation, which is a series of publications that comes out, and it's basically research-oriented. So a lot of good papers in The Conversation. I highly value it, although I have to say this one here is not all that great. They also co-published with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. They published this paper called Banning Soldiers Displaying Death Symbols is About the Right Military Mindset, Not Political Correctness, authored by Michelle Grantin, who supported the ban. And she quoted this fellow, Neil James, who's the executive director of the Australian Defense Association. And he said, it's not political correctness to stamp out ill thought through attempts to build teamwork or overdone digger black humor, digger meaning soldier. Especially where this risks conveying to the broader community that some diggers are dickheads, racists, or otherwise amateurish in their attitudes or motivation, if not in their professional skills. Soldiers understand death because they work in an unlimited liability profession. And what he meant there was unlimited liability means in your job you can get killed and it's okay to be killed in your job. But surely this strengthens the need not to glory in having to inflict it rather than the opposite. Now, what was he saying? He's saying that morale and esprit de corps are central to the issue, and research and arguments were around this point. It's really about how soldiers think of themselves. I'm not going to dissect Neil James's views here at the moment, but I will come back to them. Not everyone agreed with the ban because of the impact to morale and esprit de corps. So let's look at the counterarguments. Let's talk about what morale is in the first place. In 2018, Rand published reports for the U.S. Army stating a few things. Here we go. First quote, the will to fight is the single most important factor in war. The best technology in the world is useless without the force of will to use it and to keep using it even as casualties mount and unexpected calamities arise. Soldiers and the units they form develop the disposition to fight or not fight and to act or not to act when fearing death. Along with quality and competence, identity was a key factor in a soldier's will to fight. Very interesting. Another paper published by the U.S. Army University Press in the Military Review, when talking about cultural reform, said, "The organization's core values must not be compromised during this process. For the U.S. military, minimizing discord can be achieved by expanding military traditions." In other words, they argued not to curtail them. They wanted more of them because they saw the importance of morale and esprit de corps. We're going to tie how patches get into this in a second. The U.S. Army University Press also published a paper called Impact of Cultural Globalization on Soldiering. They acknowledged in this paper that leaders need to make adjustments for the individuality of modern recruits, but they went on to say that esprit de corps must not be sacrificed at the altar of cultural reform. Now, the U.S. service paper Stars and Stripes did a piece on the ban. And they titled it, "The Australian Army Chief Orders Ban on So-Called Death Symbols." They derided the ban. They said, you know, look, the U.S. Military Academy at West Point uses Spartan imagery. Now, these people are clean-cut people. You know, they're not killers and malingerers and axe murderers. And they went on to say, "Such a ban denigrates the morale of the enlisted, flows on, and denigrates combat power." Another study by Jeppesen and Elron titled "Exploring Morale in an Active War Zone, a Study of the Predictors of Morale During Deployments to Afghanistan." So this is fairly modern, right? They defined what morale is, and I thought this was really good. They said it's comprised of 4 points: cohesion, esprit de corps, leadership, and shared purpose. You couldn't write a more concise list of what the Spartan spirit is. That is what the Spartan army of 480 BC had. They had cohesion, esprit de corps, good leadership, and a shared sense of purpose. Exactly. These things are really important in battle. Now, key to their findings was that cohesion refers to the sense that soldiers have in a small group, so platoon size, or, you know, 10, 20, 30 people. And the paper went on to refer to another paper written by the South African Defense Force and the Stellenbosch University. And if you want to look it up, it's called "Managing Morale on the Battlefield, A Psychological Perspective." And in that paper, they supported the importance of this primary group cohesion for soldiers because it was acceptance in the primary group where soldiers gained a sense of trust for each other. And you can read some really great stuff about the Israeli soldiers and how they trusted each other in their battles of the late 60s and early 70s. They went on to say, "Esprit de corps is the bonding between soldiers and their secondary groups beyond that primary group." So we're talking about the unit now. "Esprit de corps is a higher order concept paralleling cohesion at the primary group level, implying above all pride in and devotion to the reputation of a formal organization, the unit, necessary for sustained effective performance of soldiers in combat." And they noted that esprit de corps contributes to a soldier's self-esteem and is underpinned by unit expectations, traditions, and history. So, for example, if you join the Green Berets, you know you're a Green Beret. You know the history of your unit. You know it's an elite unit. And you know that when you're performing in your group, in your unit, that there are expectations that you're going to achieve the same level. You can imagine a Spartan teenager becoming a soldier and going, "Yep, you've passed all your training. Now you're one of us." That sense of esprit de corps comes from the expectations that the soldier had by joining the unit. And it's the same for any unit in modern militaries. When you join a unit, you know what the traditions and history of that unit are, and it helps you build that esprit de corps and that cohesion. And patches and the heraldry of units are really important part of that. Now, they warned in this paper that replacing age-old customs with modern practices will result, this is a quote, "result in little to no success for the military esprit de corps because esprit de corps is what makes a soldier continue in battle." And they concluded that the modern penchant for political correctness and task orientation was failing to adequately prepare soldiers psychologically for combat because it detracted from team building and esprit de corps. I'm going to repeat this. This is really central to what we're talking about here. Esprit de corps is, quote, "necessary for sustained effective performance of soldiers in combat and what makes a soldier continue in battle." Why would you mess with something so important? Every military man or woman that has seen combat knows this. Without esprit de corps, we lose wars. Just go ask the Ukrainians how it's going. And I can tell you what, they know they're doing well because they've got good morale. They're beating the Russians today because of their morale, nothing else. So why are we messing with this? Why are we tolerating headlines like this one? And this one really got up me. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation supported the ban when they published this story called "Death Symbol Ban Isn't About Political Correctness. It's the difference between an army and a death cult." Somebody actually wrote these words. His name is August Elliott, and he wrote it on the 27th of April, 2018. And he said in the title, "It's the difference between an army and a death cult." Are you kidding me? What a joke. How can somebody actually write something like that? It makes no sense. But let's look at his arguments just to give him maybe, you know, a little bit of credit. Here we go. He presented two arguments to support his headline. The first one, and he presents the argument for and against. So he says, look, one of the arguments for keeping the symbols is that death symbology is good for morale, which is what I've been saying, a necessary part of maintaining an army capable of violence. And he counters that by saying, this is a quote, "It's all just a bonding exercise used for the purposes of group absolution." In other words, psychological relief for individuals trying to cope with the pressures of war, end quote. Right. I don't think Mr. Elliott's read a shred of research about what morale is. He just doesn't understand it, and his counterargument is completely incorrect. His second point, he said that keeping symbols was about heritage, spirit, and pride attached to the symbols. And he acknowledged, and this is a quote from his article, "Given how closely soldiers wed themselves to the customs of their forebears, such attachments shouldn't be dismissed out of hand." Hallelujah. Well done there. But then he goes on to say that these banned symbols are not our symbols. He's Australian, so he's talking about Australian symbols, because they come from other cultures. What a flippant, baseless, and irrelevant comment to make. I mean, other than the kangaroo, what isn't imported to Australia? The Australian flag got the Union Jack on it. It's imported from England. What about the 1 million Greeks in Australia? Do they not get to use the Spartan helmet? What a joke. It's media like this that perpetuates cultural reform without understanding the impact, particularly on our national security. I do agree that it's important for Western nations to differentiate between the use of military force and simply killing, but fostering morale through esprit de corps is not the same as illegal killing. Nor do death symbols lead to ill discipline that results in illegal killing. So, for example, having a Spartan helmet on a unit patch doesn't make a pilot a dickhead, right? It doesn't make a tank commander a racist. It doesn't make a ship's captain amateurish in their attitudes or suffer from an erosion of their ethos of service. Removing the Grim Reaper image from an artillery unit patch doesn't stamp out ill thought. If someone's got ill thought, they got it somewhere else. These connections are so tenuous as to be farcical and not reflective of research and findings. So let's wrap this up. No matter how much we might distort our culture in modern times, you can't wish away some basic truths about the military. The military is there to wage war when we need them to. We want our military to win. I don't know anybody that would think otherwise. We should not be putting up barriers to military effectiveness, even if they seem trivial like a patch, because every edge in combat matters. Ask yourself this. If your son or daughter is in combat, do you want them to be gung-ho about getting the job done? Or do you want them to be humiliated by the act of taking the enemy's life? Do you want your sniper son or your aircraft bomber daughter or your ship's gunner to be humble and humiliated when they inflict death? I can assure you that most snipers, tank commanders, naval gunners, aircraft pilots take great pride in hitting their targets, and even more so if they're hitting someone that's about to shoot them or shoot their mates. In my view, they should be proud of using that lethal force when they need to, and they deserve recognition when they do it well, and morale underpins that success. We simply cannot apply societal norms to military units. I want our military to do their best at killing the enemy. Perhaps even with a bit of gusto and bravado? No, let's call it a lot of gusto and bravado. Young men and women join the military because they want to be part of something special. With all the history and all the get-the-job-done culture and stoicism and minimalism that the military embodies, and it's with that spirit that comes with being part of a force that is designed to rain hell down upon the enemy in defense of our nation. That's what it means to be in the military, and you need morale to do that. Military symbology should be used to reflect a unit's history, its sense of military excellence, elitism, and Angus Campbell's got some problem with the word elitism. I'll tell you what, I want as many elite soldiers as we can get, and its warrior mentality, all of which are central to esprit de corps. We need good leadership, esprit de corps, both of which are the central tenets of morale. We can't win wars without it, and we better get our act together here with this patch stuff and this symbology and cultural reform, because it's wrong. One wonders how the West will fare when we have leaders focused on political correctness instead of inculcating something like the Spartan spirit in our soldiers. I, for one, don't want my son, who's in the Navy, coming home in a box. And if he has better morale because he has a killer patch on his shoulder and it makes him feel more like a warrior, then let him wear the patch. Well, as you can tell, this topic got me fired up, and I hope it gave you a sense of what the Spartan spirit is. Now, I'm going to wrap up each week's show by identifying someone that epitomizes the Spartan spirit in our modern world. This week's winner is Justin Huggett. Now, it's an old story here. He's a retired Australian Army sergeant who spent 14 years in the military, including a stint in Afghanistan where he earned the Medal of Gallantry. And he demonstrated the Spartan spirit by writing to Angus Campbell about that ban on death symbology. It's a fantastic read. It's very reflective of how most modern soldiers feel. Google it. His last name is spelled H-U-G-G-E-T-T. And I hope you do, in fact, go and read that and have learned a little bit about the Spartan spirit, morale, and where cultural reform is taking us and how we need to really think closely about it. Thanks for listening to The Spartan Spirits. You can find us on all the usual podcast hosting platforms, and be sure to check out my blogs on spartanspirit.au. That's one word, spartanspirit.au. Or join us on the Facebook page. And you can send me your thoughts about the podcast on my Twitter account or email me at spartan.spirit@yahoo.com. Thanks for listening.